Alaska is one of the most seismically active regions in the world. The numbers are impressive. The state experiences 12,000 earthquakes per year, more than 10% of worldwide totals. Scientists know more about the different kinds of earthquakes that can occur, but there is still no way to predict when the next one may strike or how large it will be. We'll be talking today about what is known and what is not. We'll hear from experts and listen to some archived voices from 1964 on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. And by First National Bank of Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for more than 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Devastated Alaska has begun the task of rebuilding after the greatest earthquake ever recorded. Anchorage, with a metropolitan population of 100,000 hardy souls, was in the center of the severe shock that ripped down 4th Avenue, the main shopping street. On one side of the avenue, buildings slipped into the yawning fissures. On the other side, not even plate glass windows were cracked in some shops.
Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. That's audio from a 1964 newsreel describing the destruction after the Good Friday earthquake. We'll hear a bit more of that later, as well as voices of Alaskans recalling the day of that earthquake. My guests for today's show are Cindy Preller. Cindy is the NOAA Tsunami Program Manager for the Alaska region. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning, Lori.
Thanks so much for being here. And Bridget Bashue. Bridget is the Outreach Director for the State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Hi, Bridget.
Hi, Lori.
Thanks for being in the studio. You can join our conversation. We'll be talking about earthquake activity, what's known, what the latest innovations are in technology and predictions. We'll also be talking about what you need to know to be ready for the next big event that, of course, will at some point happen here in Alaska. You can join our conversation at 550-8422 in the local area or 1-800-478-8255 outside of Anchorage. And you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Cindy, let's start with a bit of the backstory on the 1964 quake. It was a 9 or more than 9.
9.2.
Lasted more than 3 minutes?
Yeah, almost 5 minutes of shaking.
We know it's the second largest ever recorded, but how does the length of time it went on compare to other large quakes? It seems like almost 5 minutes just seems incomprehensible to me.
It is incomprehensible. It's incredible. Time is really strange in an earthquake. But there are other magnitude 9 earthquakes that have shaken for 8 minutes. And, you know, I think we can assume they'll shake for at least over 3. You know, but basically, if it's shaking that long, it's serious, so you need to take action.
So is it related to the magnitude of the earthquake then, how long the duration will be?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's actually one of our rules of thumb. So if you're in shaking for longer than 20 seconds, we think that's roughly a magnitude 7.
Oh, interesting.
If it's 30 seconds, it's a magnitude 8.
During the, just recently, during the National Weather Service, there was a media day where reporters came to the office, and that's when I met you, Cindy. You said something that just really stuck with me after that day and kind of inspired the idea for the show, that there were a number of large seismic events across the world, not just in Alaska, and then in the 1960s, and then relative calm for more than 4 decades. Then within the last decade, things have changed again. So give us some details on what was going on in the 1960s and then what you're seeing today.
Sure. Thanks. I'm glad that resonated. You know, I'm a geologist, and so we look at patterns like over millions of years, but because we've only been able to measure earthquakes since the 60s, we have two patterns, now and the 60s. And there's some earlier tracers right around the turn of the century as well, some big quakes. But, you know, so it's kind of sketchy, but it's all we have to go on, basically. But if anything is like the 60s, it should die out again, but who knows? I mean, who really knows? But we are experiencing a great number of great earthquakes right now.
Starting in 2007?
Starting in 2004 with the Indonesian Banda Aceh tsunami.
And what does that mean? What does that tell you when you see, I'm looking at some of the material that you sent to us. And by the way, listeners, you can see some of this material on our website. It's there right now, alaskapublic.org. If you go there, you can not only see some photographs, but also the video. There's state video there with the remembrances of earthquake survivors from 1964. And there's also some graphs. One of them is this one that I have in my hand here, temporal distribution of earthquakes greater or equal to 8.5 since 1900. I have no idea what that means,
but
I'm hoping you can explain it to us. It's the two peaks are fairly dramatic. You can see this on our website, alaskapublic.org, if you'd like to.
All that diagram is showing is magnitude versus years. And so it's showing that there's a cluster at the turn of the century. There's another cluster in the 60s, and then there's a cluster now. But, you know, to go from have 40 years of non-activity, you know, seismologists are just kind of, you know, trying to figure out how to do it. We can't predict earthquakes. We can use a lot of science to figure out where we think they might be. We've got a lot of good data on what kinds of earthquakes, so we know where the big ones will happen or where we expect them to happen, but we sure don't know when. So if you don't have big earthquakes to learn from, you're kind of stuck modeling and trying to figure it out. So it's a very, very new science. It's exploded since 2004.
Interesting. So how worried should Alaskans be? You're seeing this uptick in activity, and you know where the big one, the larger earthquake should strike. Mm-hmm. Where are those zones, especially for Alaska?
Well, what we look for is what we call seismic gaps. And so those are areas that haven't had much seismicity, which tells us that they could possibly be under more pressure. So the longer they're under pressure, the bigger the break. Basically, it's pretty simple. Alaska has two well-known seismic gaps right now. One is called the Yakutat Block. So it's between Cordova and Yakutat. And then the other one is out by Sandpoint. It's called the Shumagin Gap. And, you know, we have others. There's a few gaps in southeast Alaska as well. But because of the system there, they'll be smaller probably. Mm-hmm. But everything is probably, it's all caveated with, we hope, you know, because with every event we learn a ton. And we've been fairly surprised on many. You know, my fellow seismologists will have more confidence in what I'm saying. But as a tsunami scientist, we're really, really learning quite a bit every event.
1-800-478-8255 is the number to call if you'd like to join us. Or locally, 550-8422. Bridget, I want to get you in on the conversation now. How does the State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management take the information that folks like Cindy are aggregating and providing and use that for purposes of planning?
Well, one thing, you know, we've looked at what was here in 64 and what are things like now. So the state's made some, you know, enormous strides in preparation and preparedness. As Cindy said, you can't predict an earthquake, but you can definitely mitigate injury and damage to your own home and property. In 64, we had a smaller population. The building stock was different. We didn't have all the seismic codes and enforcement that is in place now. We also didn't have the population that we have now either. But that's one of the main differences. So the state has purchased a lot of, you know, after-quake emergency supplies, generators, communication systems, water supplies, and they didn't have that before. We actually have an earthquake simulator, which is a great teaching tool because people, you know, most people that didn't go through the 64 earthquake, until you've really been through an earthquake, you're not really, you don't appreciate, as Cindy said, almost five minutes is an extremely long time. And the earthquake simulator will simulate a quake at 45 seconds. And most people, after they've gone through it, they have a definite appreciation and understanding for being prepared. So that's what we try and do is get communities, get people, you know, in the old days, it was, I think, the civil defense in the schools. You see the little pictures, duck and cover. But what we, the behavior now is to drop cover and hold on. Get under something, you know, a table or whatever, hold on, you know, and protect yourself. So it's drop, cover, and hold on. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing the state is trying to do. Securing items in your home. We have earthquake strapping now. So if you have clocks or shelves or bookcases or, you know, a lot of figurines, glass or whatever, all that stuff, like it did in 64, will come tumbling down. So you can secure it because it's usually falling debris. And as Cindy well knows, most people in earthquakes, they've been killed by the tsunami in the United States versus, you know, the quake itself. But people are injured by falling debris. So that's one thing the state tries to do, is get people to prepare, be prepared, have an emergency plan, have an emergency kit. I think after Katrina and some other disasters, I think people kind of have this feeling that, well, FEMA's going to come in, fly in with the big jets and take care of everything, and it'll be fine, hunky-dory. We live in Alaska, and transportation, obviously, and our distance makes a big difference. So we want people to be prepared, have food, water, supplies. So if you are stuck on your own and have to shelter in your home, that you can survive. Now, most people in the bush really are probably better prepared than those of us in the cities, because they don't run down to the grocery store once a week or whatever. So that's one thing we're trying to do, is people to be prepared and to include your pets. You need to have emergency supplies for your animals. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the big items that the state is really working on, is being prepared.
It's interesting listening to you talk. I was thinking about this bookshelf that I have at my home, thinking, oh, I should make sure,
yes,
I tie,
yes,
that to the wall, I guess, because it would definitely tumble over. And there's also stores that stack pallets of goods. I've been in some of them, especially the warehouse type,
yes,
stores that we have in the city. Mm-hmm. And I've wondered about that very thing, walking through the aisles and seeing pallets stacked.
High piled stock or high piled storage. Yeah. Fortunately, for the most part, most of the racking stuff, there are codes that require seismic bracing. Sprinkler systems have to be seismically reinforced. So there are codes now that address a lot of that. That's not going to say that some of this, that stuff's going to fall off or won't fall off, but there are, the codes do address that for the commercial properties. But it's in your residence where normally people think, I have all these pictures or whatever, because the glass will break. Usually the structures will withstand, give quite a bit. You know, they're pretty stable, but we have a lot of stuff, mm-hmm, and stuff will go flying, and it's that falling debris. And as people find out in the simulator, they're kind of amazed. We do have items that are strapped down, and they're just amazed at how much just a computer monitor will flop around, or your flat screen TV, how much they will literally go flying. So,
well, I want to talk more about the idea of preparation. We'll get more in depth in that, but we're going to hear from some folks who survived the 1964 earthquake. We'll hear the voice of Kenneth Lester of Seward and also Avis Komkoff of Chenega.
And was just filling shelves when all of a sudden it started to shake. The first, I'd felt earthquakes before, but little tiny things. When this one hit, it started to shake and things started falling off the shelves. But I'll tell you this, it was noisy, extremely noisy. A crunching, grinding noise. And at the same time, when the poles would whip in opposite directions, the line would go twing or twang or something. If you looked up the street, you could see waves coming down the street, just like the ocean.
I could feel the movement on the floor. So I went, and I always heard the older people say, open the door. When there's an earthquake, you need to open the door. So I went and opened the door, and I grabbed the two kids and went outside with them. Water was getting real rough. Then the water went out. The water started going out. You could see more of the beach. And somebody, I don't know who, somebody hollered tidal wave. And we turned around and started just running up. And then the water just vanished, just like it fell in a hole.
Those are the voices from a short video compiled by the state of some of the survivors of the 1964 earthquake. You can see the entire video right now at our website, along with some other good information. Although, please wait until after the program and then listen to it. You can also join our conversation 1-800-478-8255 if you have questions about preparation or about seismic activity, tsunami preparedness, or locally 550-8422, 550-8422. We're talking about earthquakes and tsunamis. In that, those voices that we just heard, pretty dramatic stuff. Kenneth Lester talking about the undulations in the highway. And I was trying to picture that in my mind last night as I was gathering this audio and trying to imagine how terrifying it would be to see the what is supposed to be firm ground moving in that manner. And then the voice of Avis talking about the tsunami. Cindy, explain to us what's going on when that's happening. Obviously, the water's gathering back. But to hear her describe it, it disappeared completely.
It did.
What was going on there?
I was so lucky to be part of that interview with Avis. It was actually life-changing to hear her story. She was in Chiniga, and so they were very, very, very close to the epicenter. And so what's happening scientifically is part of the ocean floor is rising quite suddenly, and so relatively the other part is sinking. And she was on the side that sunk, and so that water was sucked out. I'm sorry, she was on the side that rose, and so the water was sucked into where it was sinking, and it went completely dry.
So it sunk, but then did it rise back up? Or how is it that then there was a tsunami?
Right, the land did not, but the water did, and that's what generates the tsunami, is just that sudden change in elevation on one side of the ocean, and basically that just lifts the entire water column, and then it reacts. And it's a tremendous amount of energy.
Now, we know that there was a terrible tragedy that happened there because the village of Chiniga was destroyed.
Yep.
Lives were lost there. How is there any way to have, I suppose it just varies so much depending on where the epicenter is and the magnitude, but how much time do people usually have from the time that they start seeing too much beach until there's going to be a huge wave?
You see too much beach, please turn around and get the heck out of there. And it's amazing. We have video footage of people running out with the ocean. In Indonesia, the fishermen ran out because the water went out so fast it left the fish behind flopping. And so the fishermen all boogied out there to get the free fish. And you're not going to be able to boogie back as fast as the water's coming in. How much time? What we learned from Honshu, the 2011 tsunami, is less than 2 minutes. Mm. And in Alaska during 64, the first tsunami was actually induced by landslides. And so in Prince William Sound and Seward, all the fjords basically lost their sea floors and had this giant massive slumping from the shaking. And that created local tsunamis that were unbelievably devastating. And those, we estimate about 90 seconds in Seward is how soon the water was arriving. So, a lot of the old earthquake safety literature says drop, cover, and hold until the shaking stops. And that is something we have to absolutely unteach if you are near the water.
So what should people do then if they're not supposed to drop, cover, and hold?
They should still drop, cover, and hold immediately as soon as they feel an earthquake. And but then they need to start counting really slowly. And time is super weird during an earthquake. Mm. It's hard to count normally. I teach kids to count their favorite things just so they can count slowly and pace themselves. But also, it helps steady the heart rate and blood pressure and gives them something positive to think about.
And is the idea to count just to try to get an idea of the magnitude and how concerning the resulting tsunami may or may not be?
It is really the single most important life-saving skill if you're next to the, especially Alaska's ocean, but any ocean, because we have such deep fjords, the tsunami will move very quickly. So if you can count to 20, you need to get up and get out of there. And it's really tricky because imagine 3 or more minutes of shaking. Now we're asking you to evacuate during an active, very dangerous earthquake, but it's super important to get the heck out of there.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255 statewide, or 550-8422, 550-8422 in the Anchorage region. We're going to hear from Shu now in Talkeetna. Good morning.
Good morning there. Thank you for having this program on. It's so pertinent.
You're welcome. Do you have a question about the Denali Fault Zone?
I do. I live up here in Talkeetna and have for quite some time, and I recall back in November of 2002 when we had a 7.9 shaker that was centered along the Denali Highway, which is not all that far from Talkeetna. And my question today is, given the proximity of the Denali Fault Zone, which is about 70 miles from the proposed dam site along the Susitna River, can you address the implications of that and even the concerns that those of us living downstream might harbor? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I am not a geologic engineer, but what I would do is I would make sure at the borough level, city level, at the permitting level, at the community meetings regarding the dam, that you insist that there is a geologic engineer on the project. Make sure that that everything about how that dam is built is that's taken into thought. There's no reason not to build a dam. But it is really important to make sure it's constructed appropriately, and it's critical to have a geologic engineer or a seismological engineer on the project.
Bridget, is there anything you wanted to add in that regard or not?
No, I agree with Cindy, and it's really important. There's with technology, there are the building materials now and stuff. Taking the seismic considerations is just really a critical factor, wherein back in 64 it wasn't done. But now that when you have new construction, that's really very, very key, very critical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a bunch of earthen dams in the state of Washington. It's something we're very worried about because they're starting to crack. It's just something you need to take into consideration, but, it doesn't mean it can't go.
Well, let's talk about the different types of earthquakes. I'm not even going to attempt to try to lay out the framework of the different types of earthquakes because that would be foolish when I have you here in the studio, Cindy.
Big versus small.
Tell us the difference between the slip strike and the other types of earthquakes.
Well, we have all there's basically three kinds. So it's pretty straightforward. And we have all three here in the state. And so
good for us.
Yeah. Yeah. The strike slip quakes are horizontal. So if you use your hands, you move back and forth. And they do not do as much surface deformation, but they sure do shake the ground a bunch. Mm. Usually they support earthquakes up into the low eights would we expect to be the highest on a strike slip. As far as the other two, there's one called a normal fault, and that's where the land moves away from each other, creating canyons and valleys. And a good area in the state where we have that is up by Nome in the Seward Peninsula. And you can tell because there's hot springs and stuff up there. And then the mother of them all is the thrust fault or the reverse fault, and that's where one plate is coming over the top of the other, and that's what builds our mountains, it's a massive collision. And those are the monster earthquakes.
And is that what we experienced in 1964?
That's exactly what we experienced in 64. And same with the Chilean and the Indonesian and Japan. These big, big quakes are all the same type of mechanism. And that's what our trench is, the Aleutian Trench.
Mm-hmm. We had an email from Steve, who's listening, and asked, as an Anchorage resident, I'm curious what the tsunami risk is in Kinnick Arm and also Turnagain Arm.
I'm so glad you asked that. The risk is almost minimal unless there's some extreme disaster we can't even begin to predict. The water in Cook Inlet is just too shallow to support the energy. So the tsunami risk coming up Cook Inlet extends just a bit north of Anchor Point. And as soon as it starts to shallow up, we don't worry so much.
Interesting. What about in areas, I was looking at the map last night as I was preparing for the show and looking at where Juneau is up that, you were talking about the fjords. These are up narrow waterways. And I spoke to someone in Sitka after the big tsunami scare down there who said, well, you know, these inner waters like this, where there's islands and things, I don't think a tsunami could really build up any steam and get going in this area. What's the reality there?
Yeah, the reality is sometimes the islands actually make the tsunami stronger because the waves will deflect and refract off of them and possibly, you know, really encourage their strength. But the real true, I mean, Southeast Alaska is definitely at risk for these distant tsunamis like from Japan or our trench. But their real risk and what is super scary for us is the landslide risk. Mm. And the largest tsunami ever recorded is in Southeast Alaska. There's so much rain there and the land is so steep that the slope stability is minimal at best in places. And the water's so deep that a tsunami, a local landslide tsunami could happen and arrive, you know, 90 seconds. Mm. So that's where it's important to count to 20, because a 20 is around a magnitude 7, but that can trigger a landslide. So that would be a very localized event. And the landslide might be underwater. So you don't have to see it falling off the, you know, off the cliff edge. It really could be triggered underwater. So it's just super important that folks take action themselves. The Warning Center cannot warn for landslides. We can't detect them seismically. Mm-hmm. So education is the only way on that one. So Southeast has a very, very real and severe hazard. And the islands, you know, yeah, they may do some diffracting from a far source tsunami, but, you know, you can't predict it, and our modeling isn't, we haven't been able to model it that fine of a mesh yet. We're getting there.
I remember the fascinating story about Lituya Bay, mm. where there was an event that scientists were puzzled over for many years that had happened, I think, in the, I don't know how long ago, but then...
58.
But, well, that event was the one that sort of explained the earlier event, mm-hmm. so that they were able to understand, well, that's what happened. It was a major landslide. And I can see why you couldn't predict those, because you have no idea of knowing when or where they could occur in so many areas. 1-800... Let's see, what is that number again? 478-8255, 1-800-478-8255 is the number to join our conversation, or you can call locally 550-8422, 550-8422. We're talking about earthquakes and tsunamis. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org, and we have a lot of information on our website at alaskapublic.org. You can check that out there. We're going to take a call now from Bob in Southeast, comment on the Denali Fault. Hi, Bob.
Hello, how are you?
We're just fine.
I live on the Denali Fault. Actually, it runs down Peril Straits and Clarence Straits. If you look at the satellite photo, you can see the big arc where the Pacific plate's blasting into Alaska. We just went through a 7.5 quake here in January, and as you say, our biggest worry is not so much tsunamis as it is mass wasting. Now, we didn't have a lot of it this last quake, but we had enough to where, you know, road crews had to get out and clear some of the slide areas, small slide areas, on our road system. I'm on Prince of Wales Island.
And so you just wanted to comment. You didn't really have a question?
Yeah, okay. I had no question. I just wanted to comment, you know, get our earthquake in there. I haven't heard anything about it yet.
Well, good job, Bob. You got your earthquake in there. Thank you. Thanks for the call.
Okay. Yeah, we made it through. All that happened to me is my coffee started slopping over on my table. I'm going, what's going on? My dogs are asleep. They're not knocking the cabin around. Hmm. Yeah, that's how I felt it. Otherwise, it just felt like a low, slow ocean swell.
Interesting. Well, we're glad you made it through with just a little spilled coffee, Bob. Thanks for the call.
Yes, me too. You know, a 9 point I'm not looking forward to.
All right. Well, take care. Thanks for the call. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be happy to take your call if you have a question about earthquakes or tsunamis on today's Talk of Alaska statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Historic Anchorage Hotel, offering amenities such as continental breakfast, 24-hour concierge service, and Wi-Fi. A boutique hotel in the heart of downtown. HistoricAnchorageHotel.com. The Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnickarm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnickarm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, your host today, and we're talking about earthquake preparedness, earthquakes and tsunamis. And Cindy, our last caller, Bob, was on Prince of Wales Island, and you were mentioning during the break that there's going to be some upcoming conference there?
Well, actually, I love Prince of Wales. I really do. And they've done a lot of work to become tsunami ready. And so we will be down there this winter trying to visit every single community on Prince of Wales to absolutely celebrate, commemorate, make sure they're as ready as they need to be, especially since they had two earthquakes. We might as well acknowledge both of them this last winter, one in January and one in October. And they're significant, and it shook people up a bit, and boy, we've had some great participation. And so, yeah, they are becoming tsunami ready, and we'll be there. So, Bob, come on out and say hi. I'd love to meet you.
Mm-hmm. And when will that be?
Not sure yet.
Okay.
Depends on the funding, and we're waiting for Craig to get their signs up and possibly some signs in Kluwak.
Bridget, can you tell us about the warning system that's in place? And I know that there are sirens in some communities. What's the status of that warning system, and how many communities have them and need them?
Sure. Cindy can answer as far as the number. I'm sort of on the peripheral, but again, a difference in 1964 and now is they didn't have tsunami warnings. Mm-hmm. And now I know a lot of people say, well, and the one caller said, well, Anchorage, we may not have a tsunami, but that doesn't mean you don't go on vacation or go fishing anywhere in Alaska to any of our coastal communities to be able to recognize the signs. Or people go to Hawaii. I notice if you go to Hawaii, you'll see the tsunami warning signs all over the place because they're very, very aware. But the tsunami warning system is the system, and it's tested to notify residents when there is, you know, when they have an event where they feel there's going to be a warning, and they set off the sirens to let people know. And as Cindy said, that's why it's important to, when they work with the tsunami ready, let people know that what are they supposed to do, where are they supposed to go, what's their plan, what's their backup plan, you know, how do they account for everybody. And that's really important with that, you know, emergency warning system that we have statewide.
How do the warning systems, the sirens, is it just a siren, or is there also some vocal information about what people should do in their communities?
There's vocal with it.
Okay, so there's instructions.
Yeah, there's instruction, and normally people hear, this is a test of the, you know, the system, but mm-hmm. there is vocal with it. But they should know and recognize, and I know within the state, I'm quite sure, and Cindy can correct me if I'm wrong, I think we all have the same siren, because there's lots of different tones when people get sirens, but I'm not sure, but at least the newer ones are all kind of the same tone. And on our earthquake simulator, we duplicated that. We have a little sample of a tsunami warning siren on the earthquake simulator, so people can know what it's going to sound like.
Okay. Let's listen to another bit of tape here. This is Linda McRae McSwain, who is a Seward resident.
But it really was, I think, close to 5 minutes, and that's a long, long time for earthquakes. All of a sudden, just at the front door is my father, and he's yelling, there's a tidal wave coming, we have to get to the top of the roof. Just see him so clear in my mind, standing down there with my stuff, and I'm just screaming at him, it doesn't matter, just you have to get up here, and you don't have any time to waste. And so he did, and we jumped, and it seems as if as soon as my dad got onto the house roof, and we were all lying down with our hands and heads at the pitch of the roof and holding hands. That wave just hit so hard and so fast that just in an instant, what had been a subdivision of probably 11 homes was instantly just gone. Everything just exploded or flattened.
So when we were talking earlier about the idea of duck, cover, and hold, and you brought in the count idea of...
Drop, cover, and hold is the new one, drop. Duck and cover used to be the old that they taught in the schools, but it's actually drop, meaning get down.
Tell
and
old
underneath.
I am now.
That's okay. You know, in the schools, and it's drop, cover, and
drop,
hold.
Cover, and drop, hold. Excuse me. Yes, let's keep that straight. Drop, cover, and hold. So with that thought in mind, holding on to something so that you're safe through the shaking, but then also counting. And if it gets beyond 20, should you then start trying to get out of there, even if the shaking's still going on?
Absolutely. Unless you are hearing something otherwise from your local emergency manager, you know, unless you're hearing the sirens telling you to stay, or you're, you know, if you're on your own and you're making your own decision after 20 seconds, you should evacuate. Mm. And that's really tricky. And something we, you know, I throw out to teachers to really think about. You know, how are you going to evacuate your classroom? Because you still need to protect your heads and your neck, and you will be ducking, actually.
You will duck from those drawing books.
Yeah, and some of the kids have come up with some pretty neat things, like they've got portable tables that they're all going to get under together and walk out together. You know, like if you had a canoe over your head type thing. And so, you know, they have to come up with that on their own and make their own plans that makes the most sense for them. But it's important. Those local landslides, especially an underwater slump, that tsunami will arrive without any warning. Mm-hmm. So the only thing you have is that local 20 seconds of shaking.
And this is primarily for those communities that are...
On the coast.
On the coast.
Right on the coast.
Coastal communities, the ones that are most likely to have the tsunami.
Yeah, if you're not next to the ocean, stand to the table.
Yeah, you don't need to.
Well, let's talk about that safety zone. I've heard a lot of debate about where you should be when there is an earthquake. The old thinking was stand in a doorway. I was always an advocate of I will run outside because I don't want things falling on my head. But I know that there's, of course, dangers going outside as well. There was a theory called the golden triangle.
The triangle of life. Yes.
Explain what that is, Bridget.
What that was in that the testing and all that research was done in third world countries where you had structures that were did not fall under the same building codes that the United States and some other countries have. So they were not as stable. They did not have seismic bracing, unreinforced masonry. So therefore, a lot of the buildings are going to pancake. But in the United States, for the most part, I mean, most of our structures don't fall under that. So that's where that triangle of life came from. And then it was sort of like, well, get in the doorway. That's one of the strongest places in your house. Well, if they're number one, you have to get to the doorway. And a lot of times, as you know, if you're in a strong earthquake, to get up, people get injured getting up and trying to get to run out to get out. Everybody in your family is not going to fit in your doorway. So that's why it's drop, cover, hold on. Just get something to protect, most likely a table or something you can get under just to protect yourself from falling debris. When you go outside, as really indicated in the San Francisco earthquake, there's a lot, a lot of the buildings now are built pretty well, but they have facades, they have brick, they have decorative material, there is glass, there is all kinds of falling debris. One of the callers was talking about there's power lines that can snap and come down, so you are much safer to stay in and drop, cover, and hold on. Reminding yourself to count and thinking, if this is ever going to end, but... that's the safety, but that's what you want to do. You just want to protect yourself from the falling debris.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's real important to have a plan. If everybody in your family knows, you know, earthquakes are, you know, anytime, day or night, just like structure fires, you need to know that if your kids are in their bedroom, you know, where are you going to go? Just look at how are you going to get? What are you going to get under? What can you get under? You know, if you're in your bed, get the pillow over your head to protect yourself from, you know, falling debris.
There was, in October, there was an exercise, the Great Alaska Shakeout.
Yes.
And that was not just in Alaska, it was worldwide.
Yes, nationwide.
Millions.
Yes.
Millions of people signed up, and 40-some thousand in Alaska.
49,000.
It was quite extraordinary that so many people got involved. So was the idea there just to have people practice a plan?
Yes. And I'm glad you mentioned that. That's a perfect segue, because for the anniversary, the 50th commemoration of the Great Alaska Earthquake, there is going to be a Great Alaska Shakeout on March 27th. Now, the earthquake took place, started at 5:36, but we're going to do the drop, cover, hold on drill at 1:36. All across the state, and it's just for Alaska.
Mm.
So you'll be able to go onto the website and register, just like you did for the Great Alaska or the Great Shakeout, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
But this one is just for us, and it's to commemorate the 1964 earthquake. But yes, it's to get people used to, you know, it's like, okay, you know, am I really going to do this? How am I going to do this? And it's, you know, it's just a good drill. It just practiced. You know, practice makes perfect. You always want to practice. Practice your exit plans. Practice your emergency plans. You know, get your emergency kit. And that's why it's just really important to get people thinking. It's, as Cindy says, it's not if, but when. You know, we're number one in the United States for earthquakes.
So. And I think also that people need to be reminded to print out phone numbers, because
yes.
There's an assumption that you're always going to have cell service, or you'll be able to log on and get at your contacts list. And that's not the case. I know that I keep printouts of all of our contacts, both here and with reporters across the state. So when something happens, it'd be really bad if you couldn't go to work just because your internet connection was down.
And we have checklists and stuff. We have a whole emergency and critical documents. But people used to know phone numbers, but with the advent of cell phones now, people don't.
Right.
You know, especially young people, they don't have any idea. They just key it in, and your cell, if the cell towers are functioning, if we even have cell service, which we probably will not, you need to have that as part of your plan so that you know the phone numbers.
Absolutely.
That's really important.
And having a place where families can meet is also important.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a call now from Guy in Valdez. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning. Hey, very interesting show. Hey, have you studied any of the earthquakes from, you know, like the past? Like, I was listening to a while back on one of the NPR programs, and they had Robert Ballard on there, the guy that did the dives at the Titanic and at the Bismarck and stuff. And he was invited to by Turkey to do some dives in the Black Sea, and he was saying that area at one time had just collapsed, and all of the water from the Mediterranean ran in there. And what would be the Richter scale on something like that, or that Santorini, you know, that erupted in the Mediterranean back about 12,000 BC? And I'll take my answers off the air. And very good program, too, by the way.
Thank you, Guy. Bye. Thanks for the call.
Cindy.
That's a Cindy question.
4,000 points, Cindy.
Yeah.
Hi, Guy. Thank you for that question. There's a few different parts to it, but when I think about some of the major volcanoes erupting, they usually are erupting between the big ones are erupting between the magnitude 4 and 6 range. I need some of my friends at AVO to help me on that to see if I'm out of line, but I do recall being on duty at the Warning Center in Palmer when Kasatoshi erupted, and that was larger than they usually have, and we registered it as at a 5.7. And it certainly wasn't as big as some of the Italian eruptions or Krakatoa either, which was felt around the world. So there can be, you know, they can be pretty high, but they tend to, magnitude-wise, be a little lower.
We're going to take some other calls here in a second, but there was an email that came in from Mark who says he's curious about what the latest information about large human-made bodies of water is regarding creating earthquakes. He said, I believe there's some evidence from China that with new dams and the resulting water body, I guess he's relating to the size, that maybe it's somehow creating earthquakes. Have you heard anything about that, Cindy?
Well, I mean, this is the same thing when we get back to geologic engineering, which is really important to always include those folks on your development teams. But Sure. If you affect the water table in any way, it'll affect the pressure on the rocks. And so even here in the States, in the middle of the country, South Dakota, they were experiencing earthquakes from fracking there. And I recall as a child experiencing earthquakes in Denver from drilling. And so, yeah, it's possible. They're going to be small, but it's possible to induce them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a call from Paul in Palmer. He has a comment about water levels on the Kinnick River. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Hello.
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 Your question?
Hello, can you hear me? Yeah, it was told to me by some of the old-timers in 64 that the Kinnick River disappeared when the earthquake happened for a while, and then eventually it came back again. And so I was wondering if there's a fault there, and that's why it disappeared. And the other one was why or how far up in Japan the water went to 90 feet, and it's probable maybe... Could that happen in Prince William Sound and all the fjords and inlets and bays and Whittier and stuff like that?
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for the question.
Those are my questions.
All right. Thank you.
Awesome. Keep me on track. Okay, Lori.
Yeah.
So Alaska is made of a bunch of little chunks of land that are all amalgamated together like a bunch of different pieces of Play-Doh, but they're bounded by faults. So basically, pretty much most of our river valleys are faults. We have so many faults in this state, it's not even funny. So yes, the Kinnick River is on a fault, so is the Matanuska. Yes, the Kinnick River easily could have disappeared in 64. And that's a phenomenon that happens in earthquakes frequently. Water bodies will disappear, and then there'll be blowholes places later. And it's that same thing with the water pressure and the water table is changing the rock pressure. And so, you know, it'll completely reroute the water table. So the fact that the Kinnick disappeared makes sense. And then can there be super high tsunamis in Prince William Sound? Yes, absolutely. They're fjords, they're deep water, and we have those measured from 64. So absolutely. Did I nail them all?
Japan.
Oh, well, that was in relation to Prince William Sound.
Right, yeah, the height of it.
Yeah.
Let's hear from Charlie now in Homer. Charlie has a comment about hot spots for volcanoes. Charlie?
Yeah, good morning. Good programming. I just want to know if Alaska has a hotspot volcano similar to what is happening down the Big Island, Yellowstone, and if that fits into the... Because I know we, in 1868, the Big Island of Hawaii was suffering at one point there 5,000 earthquakes a day, and when the lava finally hit the ocean, there was a 9.0 earthquake that was caused just by that movement of lava. Did you comment on that?
Okay, thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Charlie. The Hawaiian volcanic island chain is caused by a solitary magma body where the cold Pacific plate is moving over the top of it. So the magma itself is staying still. But as the plate moves across the top of it, it creates new Hawaiian islands. And our ability to actually measure earthquake energy has not been what it is today since the 60s. That's really when it started. So any measurements you have in the 50s and earlier than that, so certainly in the 1800s, those are going to be suspect as far as how they equate to how we understand energy today. So whether or not it was 9, I'm not sure, but I know it was really big. And do we have hot spots in Alaska? Nothing like what Hawaii is, but we have that area up by Nome on the Seward Peninsula that could be considered by some as a hot spot. It's similar to Yellowstone where we have the rifting, but it's not the same geological mechanism. So No, as far as I know, we don't have an Alaskan hot spot that's similar.
All right. Well, thanks for the great calls. We're going to take another short break here, and we'll be talking more about preparedness when we come back as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com.
The Older Persons Action Group, publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families, can be read online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Homes in the residential area at Turnagain are tumbled and broken among the fissures. It is as if some giant hand had swept dolls' houses from cardboard foundations. Scientists estimate that the Alaska earthquake was 35 times as strong as the San Francisco quake of 1906 and 10 times as strong as the Assam Egypt tremor, until now rated as the greatest shock in history. Kodiak to the southwest was almost wiped out. First, it was hit by the earthquake, and then hours later, three tidal waves followed one another up the channel and overran the city. Economically dependent on the fishing industry, Kodiak lost 40 of its fleet of 100 boats. The fishing and canning industry in Alaska has been brought to a complete halt. Docks, boats, processing plants, warehouses, railroad lines, they're all gone.
Again, some very dramatic newsreel audio from 1964 after the great earthquake here. Bridget, I wanted to get just a little more in-depth about the idea of being prepared and what the expectation should be. As you mentioned, people may think that FEMA is going to ride in and help out, but what's the reality of what the government's expectation is for citizens, especially in those first few days?
Right. Well, even the first few minutes or first few hours. First, every person is their own emergency manager, and the preparedness starts with the individual, then to the family, then to the community, and then to the state, to the local community, then the state, then the federal. Mm-hmm. So depending on what happens, it's going to be at least 7 days that you should be prepared for, and that's kind of a lot. But if you're prepared for it, it's not that difficult. It's not that you have to go buy special food or special things. It's you buy and store things that you normally have, but just keep them on site. A good way to do it for your home emergency kit is one of those big plastic garbage tubs. And you can put food in there, you know, that's got a long shelf life. Mm-hmm. Food that you normally eat. You know, you need to have water. I mean, in 64, the sewer systems, the water systems, power, everything was out. So you need to have that. And for your pets, have enough food. Make sure you have a flashlight. Make sure you have a battery-operated radio, because you're going to get most of your information from the broadcast, the radio broadcast stations. That's where most of your information is going to come from. And it'll be at least, you've got to plan on at least 7 days. And that's the ideal. Now, if your home, as Cindy was talking about, if you do have to evacuate, you should have an individual kit. Have your you need to have winter clothes that you can grab right then, right now. Flashlight, extra batteries, you know, your medications. You can make a list of your critical documents. Pretty much everybody now has a cell phone. So even just like your deed to your house or your mortgage payment, your insurance information, you can just photograph that on your cell phone. Photograph your children, you know, so that you have your children and your pets, so that you can say, oh, yes, this is my daughter. You know, all kinds of different people get separated, they get lost. And if somebody say, oh, if one of the Red Cross shelters is, you're looking for your daughter, this is who she is. So you can photograph that, very inexpensive. And you can have the documents, you have your prescriptions. So if you need medication, so you need to have all that in your kit so that when you are ready to go. And just cycle through it so it won't go stale. So you just, okay, if you like a lot of spaghetti, you got spaghetti noodles. Okay, just like, you know, sure, replace them. Same with, you know, there's lots of bottled water. And you want to make sure you have that. Have your supplies, you know, some extra clothing, you know, anything special needs that you have. Just make sure you have that, that you have it there and you've got it on site. So even if everything's all amiss, you know where that container is. Mm-hmm. And you can access it.
Well, I think that idea of, first of all, I want people to remember that you're saying at least a week.
Yes.
That you need to figure out at least 7 days to take care of yourself and
yes,
your family. And don't expect the government's going to ride it on a white horse and bring you some bottled water, because that may not happen for many days. And the idea of taking photographs of important documents, of mm-hmm. family members, of belongings, yes. that's an excellent idea. And then I would also suggest emailing those to somebody outside.
Yes, and that was, I was going to say, have a remote site contact person that knows pretty much everything. You can email that, have it off sites, make duplicates. You can make copies of documents also and have them in a safe place, you know, unless you happen to have a waterproof safe or whatever. But yeah, you can email that, and it's just all in the preparation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are excellent suggestions. We're going to take one more quick call here. This is Lisa in Thompson Pass calling about disaster communication. Hi, Lisa.
Bridget, you were speaking earlier and made a comment in regards to the state. You said the state's working on being prepared.
Yes.
And I guess my concern is that there's no codes for commercial or residential communication. And in every real and drill disaster that I've experienced in this area in the last 2.5 decades, the lack of communication mm-hmm. has time and again proven more disaster than the impending disaster. And the 06, the 10906 flood was a perfect example where you had the state, the city, the civil guard, Alyeska, and no communication whatsoever between any of those entities, which was therefore causing further disasters. So I guess my curiosity is what's being done to address the communication aspect.
Oh, excellent question. And what you're saying is also true of localized disasters, too, when you have a lot of multi-agencies. But the state now, they have a mobile emergency operations center. They also have what's called RapidCon. And those are the new communication systems that are transportable either by air or the ground system. And they can be set up in anywhere. And that gives them phone contact with the outside world, everything. So they are all set up, and that's what the state has done, and that is fairly recently. So that would make sense that they didn't have it before, but that is also brand new. But communications is always difficult, and especially in when you have, you know, you're out in remote sites where you don't have cell phones or you don't have cell towers. So, you know, what are you going to do? The normal phone system. But the MEOC, as it's called, the Mobile Emergency Operations Center, is set up for that, as are the RapidCon communication systems that the state has.
Yes, Cindy.
Super fast. Sorry, I just want to jump in super fast. We're going to be testing the entire state, federal all the way down to the community level, for the anniversary.
Well, thanks to my guests, Cindy Preller and Bridget Bashu. Thanks to Dave Waldron and Monica Goki on the phones. This has been a program of great interest. Steve Heimel will be back with you next week for Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. And by Providence Imaging Center, with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. provimaging.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.